Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 9th of March. A recent Washington Post article says that 2016 could be a very difficult year for LGBT activists. In state legislatures across the nation, it's shaping up to be a year for many groups. Less than 8 months after the Supreme Court legalized same-sex marriage nationally, advocates are on the defensive, playing whack-a-mole, the article says, with a massive number of bills in state legislatures they said are meant to peel back LGBT rights. The Human Rights Campaign has tracked some 150 bills that it classifies as unfriendly. One of those, this morning, the Missouri State Senate passed a religious freedom bill that could change the state's constitution. This despite a 39-hour filibuster by Democrats. If this should become law, the Constitution would be amended to include language about the protection of certain religious organizations and individuals from being penalized by the state because of their sincere religious beliefs or practices concerning marriage between two persons of the same sex. We have a lot of territory to cover this hour. In February, the Leadership Conference Education Fund released a report striking a balance, advancing civil and human rights while preserving religious liberty. It's a very interesting historical perspective how religious arguments used today against LGBT equality have been used to oppose abolition of slavery, women's suffrage and equality, racial integration, interracial marriage, immigration, the Americans with Disabilities Act, and the right to collectively bargain. Our guest this hour is Wade Henderson. Wade is the president and the CEO of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights and the Leadership Conference Education Fund. He has written many, many articles on civil rights and public policy issues, and we're delighted to have him with us. This organization, the Leadership Conference, has become one of the nation's most effective advocates for civil and human rights. For you to join our conversation with Wade this hour, we welcome your phone calls, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, or we love to hear your comments. And we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Wade, thank you very much for being with us. Hello.
Kathleen, hello, and thank you so much for having me. Yeah, I'm honored to join you.
Our pleasure, and we have so much to cover. The history on this is also quite fascinating. But let's start with these 150 bills that the Human Rights Campaign, and I'm sure your organization as well, has classified as unfriendly to LGBT people. There are so many of them. A backlash, is it, to the Supreme Court decision?
I think it's fair to say that it's a bit of a backlash. It's obviously something that has been brewing for quite some time. In fact, if we were to go back in time just to 2009, a group of activists at that point issued a declaration making it clear that religious beliefs are paramount and that they should be allowed to make decisions, even if those decisions are discriminated against others. We found that to be terribly disturbing, but I think since the Supreme Court issued its decision in the Obergefell marriage equality case last year, we've seen a number of states now totaling 150 bills that have been introduced to try to allow individuals who want to discriminate against the LGBT community or individuals in that community can do so using their religious beliefs as a shield. And that's something our country really has not done before, and it's deeply disturbing.
Is it partially because the federal government has not been forceful enough in passing anti-LGBT discrimination legislation, so the states have stepped in?
No, it's a great question, Kathleen, but I don't think that's the case. I mean, you know, the advance of legal equality for lesbian, gay, you know, bisexual, transgendered people is one of in a long history of successes in challenging institutional discrimination and dismantling legal barriers to opportunity. I mean, our country is really a case study of the evolution of its constitutional principles to move toward equality in a way that is highly commendable. I mean, I think about my own life. I'm now an individual in my 60s. I grew up in the nation's capital in Washington, D.C., and the first quarter of my life was lived under racial segregation comparable to what South Africa practiced with apartheid. And yet today there is a level of functional equality, not equality in total fact because there are institutional barriers that still pose a problem, but we have moved as a country toward a level of equality that is commendable and should be saluted. And because we are a work in progress, what that means, in effect, is that we're working to build a country that's as good as its ideals. And that means providing equality for everyone and measuring that equality by a single yardstick. And I think when you look at how the evolution of rights on behalf of the LGBT community has moved forward, it's one of the great stories of American jurisprudence. It culminated, of course, in the Supreme Court's decision last year in the marriage equality case known as Obergefell versus Hodges. And that decision, of course, held that the violation, or rather the refusal to acknowledge marriage by same-sex individuals was a violation of both of the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause, but also the Equal Protection Clause. And while that was a 5-4 decision, it nonetheless broke barriers that had existed for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, some states have now decided, well, look, we want to create a right that, in effect, protects individuals who want to discriminate against LGBT individuals, and we're going to do so under their religious beliefs. So here's what it allows them to do. You know, you have a religiously affiliated schools, for example, that are allowed to fire women because they became pregnant while not married. Or business owners who refuse to provide insurance coverage for contraception for their employees. Or pharmacies turning away women seeking to fill birth control prescriptions under some misguided view that they have the moral right to refuse a public activity. And of course, last year's effort by Kim Davis, the county clerk in Kentucky who refused to issue marriage licenses under the argument that those licenses violated her religious beliefs and then spent 6 days in jail, was an indication of how far some would carry those arguments. Of course, she never considered the fact that she was an elected official who had certain official responsibilities, and if she chose not to do them, she could have easily fulfilled that requirement by simply giving up the job. But her view is that she wants her cake and she wants to eat it too, meaning she wants to have the job, but she wants to be able to use her religious beliefs as a shield against equality, and that's something that we're deeply concerned about.
Let's look at what happened in Missouri just this morning. The Senate passed a religious freedom bill that could change the state's constitution. It has to be voted on, I understand, by the people who live in Missouri. The constitution would be amended to include language about the protection of certain religious organizations and individuals from being penalized by the state because of their sincere religious beliefs or practices concerning marriage between two persons of the same sex. I would imagine that that is a decision that may trouble you. Can you explain why?
Oh, sure. Look, the one thing we can't have is, and as a country I'm talking about, is an unwritten or explicit rule that says that discrimination is justified if the person discriminating really, really objects to the excluded group. You know, and whether explained in religious terms or not, it undermines the entire idea of civil rights protection and respect for other individuals. Look, we have long believed that religious liberty is a fundamental civil right, a founding American value guaranteed by the First Amendment. But we also believe that equal protection under the law is a fundamental American and constitutional principle. And, you know, the belief that each individual should be able to live free from discrimination is a core American value. And these two instances have come into conflict in part because there are some who believe that the equality principle, when applied to the LGBT community, goes a step too far. And that means that they, in turn, can adopt discriminatory practices as a way of, you know, under the guise of religion, in a way that I think is just terrible. Now, as I mentioned once before, there was a statement issued in 2009. It's called the Manhattan Declaration. It was issued by a group of conservative, evangelical, and Catholic activists. And the signers of that statement proclaimed that they would refuse to, and I quote, bend to any rule purporting to force us to bless immoral sexual partnerships, treat them as marriages, or the equivalent, or refrain from proclaiming the truth as we know it about the morality and immorality and marriage and the family. Now, that's a strong declaration, but it reminds me very much of a declaration that was issued after the Supreme Court issued its decision in Brown versus the Board of Education. And it was a declaration primarily of Southern congressmen and senators. It was called the Southern Manifesto. And it essentially pledged the signers to resist any effort to promote integration as a result of the Supreme Court's decision. And that same resistance to the equality principle is being applied now against the LGBT community because of the marriage equality decision. So yes, we're deeply concerned about this effort to use religious views and beliefs as a justification for discriminating against individuals whose constitutional rights require that they be treated equally. Mm-hmm.
And something that we would think would be appalling right now, religion and appeals to religious liberty, in a very interesting paper that in study of this that your organization has done, has been used throughout history. Why don't we go to slavery justified in the Bible? Jefferson Davis said slavery was established by decree of Almighty God and sanctioned in the Bible.
I mean, not unbelievable, because, of course, it reflected the views of that time. But yes, Kathleen, you're right to bring up the history of how religious views have been used to shield against equality or to argue in favor of discrimination. And yes, the treatment of African Americans as slaves was frequently buttressed by religious views, or the denial of rights to women frequently buttressed by religious views. But fortunately, our Constitution has been sufficiently broad and allowed us to understand that equality is something ingrained in the American experience. Most Americans support that. And when they think about how our country has responded over time to discrimination, but now has moved beyond that, I think we're all very proud of the fact that as Americans we recognize the importance of the Constitution. I think what we're seeing now with these so-called religious freedom statutes is a throwback to an earlier time that argues that the LGBT community or individuals of that community don't deserve the equality that the rest of us enjoy. And that's a principle that I think even the founders of our republic would ultimately challenge, even if at the time they wrote the Constitution, they had not envisioned these mm-hmm. questions.
The articles I've been reading the last day look at the number of states, and I was amazed to read there are 28 states that can legally yes. refuse service to someone who is gay. The number is higher for transgender people. People can be denied housing based on their sexual orientation. Job discrimination is prevalent. Whose responsibility is that to outlaw that? Is that, back to what I was asking before, is that not yeah. federal legislation that's needed so this can't happen?
Well, federal legislation is needed. You're absolutely right, Kathleen. And let me give you an example. Several years ago, the Leadership Conference issued a report called Cause for Concern, Hate Crimes in America. It was 1996. It was the first time that a report had been written that comprehensively examined the problem of hate crimes in our country. And it identified that hate crimes frequently were meted out against individuals because of their race, African Americans or ethnicity, Latinos who were suspected of being immigrants and therefore preyed upon, or for that matter, religious minorities like Jewish community members who were frequently targeted by anti-Semites who wanted to, you know, essentially do violence to them, and in a way that was so fundamentally un-American that I think our Congress, in a bipartisan way, thought that there should be a hate crime statute that would prevent that kind of action from taking place or add additional penalties when they occurred. It was clear when we started in 1996 that one community that was left out of this effort was the LGBT community, and that people could be beaten and attacked with impunity simply because the victim of their action was a gay or bisexual or lesbian. And that kind of concern, when highlighted by stories of the actual violence, really prompted the country ultimately to grapple with that violence and to pass the James Byrd Matthew Shepard Hate Crimes Prevention Act, which for the first time included the LGBT community as a protected class. It was a major breakthrough. But then we realized, of course, that individuals could be denied the right to housing. They could be fired from their jobs. And even with the decision in marriage equality, it doesn't stop some of those adverse consequences from happening. And so there is now a major push for a comprehensive civil rights bill that would protect LGBT individuals in, you know, many aspects of their lives, seeking housing, protections for jobs, and against the kind of discrimination that this country has long banned. And that is needed. But, you know, what we're now seeing is this response or reaction, rather, to the Supreme Court's decision of last year. And you're seeing more and more states introducing statutes like the one Missouri adopted or at least passed along yesterday that would allow precisely this kind of discrimination against the LGBT community, and in doing so clearly demonstrates how un-American it is. Now, I am concerned that, unfortunately, the kind of rhetoric that we have heard in the aftermath of the marriage equality decision, that somehow religious freedom was being impaired because individuals were being asked to do their jobs and issue licenses or provide other services that they are contracted to do by virtue of public protections that they receive that allow them to do so. So, you know, for us, it's a concern. When someone applies to become a merchant and gets the licenses necessary to sell properties, or rather items in their stores, they should be required to provide services to all who come. They can't make decisions about who to serve based on an individual's race or religion. That is precisely why the civil rights statutes of the 1960s were adopted. And to see them now twisted in some way to justify discrimination against the LGBT community is a great disturbance.
We welcome phone calls for our guest. Our guest this hour is Wade Henderson, President and CEO of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights and the Leadership Conference Education Fund. They have recently done a very extensive report, striking a balance, advancing civil and human rights while preserving religious liberty. And it documents how religious arguments that have been used today against the LGBT equality and that have been backlash bills to the same-sex marriage decision by the Supreme Court are popping up in states all over the United States. Our guest says that for as long as people have demanded freedom, dignity, and equality under the law, many arguments to deny these rights have been wrapped in a false flag of religious liberty. What do you think? Here's our phone number. We'd love to hear from you. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. We're on Facebook, Kathleen Dunn Show, and Twitter, @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, two phone calls, and let's start our calls this hour with Jim in Rice Lake. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Kathleen. I think the courts are going to continue to make a distinction between state-colored and state-sponsored activities such as licensures versus private organizations. For example, the Masters Golf Tournament has a country club that continues to discriminate against women membership because it is considered legally a private entity. I believe this public state action, licensure versus private organization entity, will affect the LGBT community legally. I'd be interested in your guest response.
Thanks, Jim.
Jim, I think you're absolutely right that this distinction that you've noted is an important one. Let me say, when government action is involved, obviously this changes the context of the First Amendment, which was intended to protect against government action. The licensure process that offers or authorizes individuals to carry out services that are exclusive to the benefit of the licensee is the kind of thing that government uses its power to promote. And so when a license is given, an individual can't then choose to apply the practices of his or her industry in a way that he or she deems appropriate, and using their religious beliefs to justify against carrying at their function. So when someone decides that they won't bake a cake or provide pizza to a party that, you know, an LGBT individual is sponsoring, you have a license to carry out these public functions, and we have every right to expect that you will do so. If that conflicts with your religion, you can certainly give up the license and respect your religious beliefs, but you can't have it both ways. And I think that's really where we're coming from. But Kathleen, I want to answer another question that I thought you posed early on, which was, you know, why are we seeing this? I mean, why this kind of resistance? Why does it seem to be growing? And I think in part it is because the public sees resistance in a lot of different ways. This analogy may not be perfect, but I think it's accurate as well. You know, Senator Ron Johnson has made a decision to oppose the obligation of President Obama to appoint a Supreme Court justice to fill the vacancy left by the untimely death of Justice Scalia. You know, the president has an obligation, Kathleen, under Article 2, Section 2, Clause 2 of the Constitution, and the Senate has an obligation to offer its advice and consent. By refusing to even consider a nominee, having a courtesy visit, having a hearing and a vote on the actual nomination, the, you know, Senate is offering, at least the Republican leadership, a unique interpretation of its advice and consent responsibility. And I think individuals see, you know, some of our lawmakers, you know, in the case of Senator Johnson and others, resisting certain constitutional principles which they find unattractive in favor of others. And that kind of selective application of the Constitution helps to encourage the kind of thing I think we're seeing now with statutes being introduced under the so-called religious freedom principle. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a point of real concern.
To say nothing of the state of civil discourse in the presidential race, I mean, it's pretty appalling, some of it, isn't it?
It is absolutely appalling, and I think regardless of party affiliation, some of the presidents of the past would be deeply offended by what has gone on in the conversation so far. It's a point of real concern, I think, for all Americans.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Jim, for the call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. This certainly has become, according to talk show conversations on commercial media and discussions on state level, a lot of press on the issue of bathroom bills. Should people be allowed to use bathrooms and locker rooms based on the gender they were born with or the gender they identify with? Why has this become front and center, and is this a very large issue for you?
You know, I don't think, well, first of all, it is an important issue because it essentially is a proxy for whether individuals will be respected for the choices they've made and the lives they choose to live, and whether they are entitled to equality regardless of their sex or gender or who they are. There are certain human rights that we all share, and I think the right to personal fulfillment in determining how one will live their life is one of those human rights that deserves respect. I think this question of whether this is a big problem for the nation obviously has to be put in context. It's an important principle, but clearly it doesn't. You know, it's not an issue that individuals confront daily. I think it's become a proxy for this larger fight, and that's why it's become so deeply troubling. And I think it is, Kathleen, tied to the very debate we're having now about these so-called religious freedom statutes and whether someone's religious beliefs should shield them against, you know, the quality of principles that the state determines are useful. And I think this is the kind of debate that we're having now. But I think your show is contributing, hopefully, to a better understanding of some of the principles involved.
You know, what is it, though, with our lack of understanding? I can't quite figure out what's going on in this country right now, Wade, with some of the conversation that's taking place with the anti-immigration feeling, with the anti-LGBT and some of these bills and some of the rhetoric. What are we responding to? What's America, not all of America, but the dominant conversation has become fairly disturbing in many ways. Why?
Well, it is disturbing, and I think, you know, our country is facing a number of internal stresses and stresses from abroad. and we are dealing with them in a way that I hope helps to reinforce our democratic principles overall. But I think we are struggling with a number of factors together. I think some Americans are having real difficulty in dealing with the demographic change that our country is experiencing, both because of internal change due to birth rates, but also immigration, and that's become a factor. I think the middle class of our country has been buffeted by lots of stresses and strains brought about by a bad economy that hasn't fully rebounded. I think the president, by the way, has done a very decent job in trying to help the economy grow, and I think the monthly job numbers have helped to bring that about. But there's also something that has happened for the last 7 years or so that's been a great concern to me, and that is there was strong opposition to the president from the Republican majority in Congress at the time of his election, or rather that came about shortly after his election, with people like Senator McConnell sort of dedicating themselves to making the president a one-term president, and doing so by essentially obstructing efforts to move the country forward consistent with the responsibilities that both the president and Congress have under our Constitution. So the decision, for example, to block confirmation of judges at the federal district court so that the next president will have the ability to fill those vacancies has helped create judicial emergencies in courts all across the country and has now led for the first time to this kind of ideological blockade on a Supreme Court appointment. That's a great concern. You see it around issues like the national debt and whether to raise the debt ceiling and a willingness to drive our economy off the global tracks in favor of making the president look bad on some issues. Even instances where he's addressing a joint session of Congress and called a liar loudly by a member of Congress. I mean, those kinds of signs of disrespect for the presidency as well as the president have helped to, I think, coarsen our debate in this country and has made, you know, the average American really confused about sort of where the country is going. I expected more from our leaders, and I'm disappointed that some of them have not shown the kind of grace in office that one would have expected. But I think you have now seen this devolution of attitude. So I would say, you know, the phenomenon that we're seeing with Mr. Trump's ascension as a leader in the election cycle is brought about in part by that hatred directed toward the president by some who were in office and the Tea Party sentiments that have really been hostile toward government in all of its forms. And the two together have resulted, I think, you know, not alone, and I'm not, you know, trying to assign blame here in a partisan way, but I think that the debate around civil issues has really coarsened in the last, you know, several years, and it's a great concern.
Wade Henderson is our guest, president and CEO of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights and the Leadership Conference Education Fund. We're talking about the number of state bills that the Human Rights Campaign has classified as unfriendly to LGBT people. We're outlining what they are. And also, we've done a little bit of history here, but we'll do more as we carry on throughout American history, according to a report that Wade's organization did. Religion has animated social justice movements designed to advance the common good and bring America's lived reality more in line with stated ideals, but also appeals to religious liberty have been used to resist and suppress those same justice-seeking movements, and we're talking about them and how they apply to the LGBT community, and we're going beyond that as well this hour. And welcome to your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Bob in Amherst Junction, hi.
Hi.
Hi, Bob.
So, you know, I talked to a number of people on this issue who quote the Bible, and some people who quote the Bible on, you know, Christ's position on homosexuality really describe it in very general terms that an individual could choose to interpret those phrases one way or another way. And it seems like, you know, the people who want to interpret the Bible to be to discriminate and to use the Bible to justify their you know, their position, they interpret it one way. But it could just as easily be interpreted the other way. And so I'm wondering if it really is more about how the person is before they read it or before they hear about it.
Wow. Bob, you're very insightful, and that's a very sharp observation. Look, I think, you know, I'm not an expert on the Bible. I don't purport to be. But I know that the Bible contains many, many verses, thoughts, ideas that can be used to justify almost any position that you hold. Individuals that sometimes use the Bible as the basis for their decision are hiding behind biblical verse to address positions that they've taken long before they read them in the Bible itself. You know, and there's an inconsistent application of principles. I mean, sometimes, you know, people will quote the Ten Commandments and say, thou shalt not kill. And yet, those individuals may still support the application of the death penalty for criminal activity in our own country. I mean, there are instances where the Bible has been perverted to reflect a particular point of view. Kathleen was talking about the way in which religious views have been used in the past to justify political activity, and they're good examples of that. You know, during slavery, there was a book in 1852 entitled The Bible Defense of Slavery and Origin, Fortunes, and the History of the Negro Race, and it includes, you know, an assertion that the, quote, institution of slavery received the sanction of the Almighty in the patriarchal age, that it was incorporated into the only national constitution which ever emanated from God, and its legality was recognized and its relative duties relegated by our Savior when upon earth. Now, the truth is, that is, you know, a fiction. But to make that assertion to justify slavery is, of course, something that was done. And the same can be true of discrimination against women, against immigrants, and against people with disabilities. And there are ample examples in the report that Kathleen alluded to that make that case. Bob, I think your analysis is spot on. And I think what you're seeing now are individuals who are using religious beliefs to cover basic attitudes that they've already adopted, in this instance against the LGBT community, but not simply limited to LGBT individuals. It applies, could apply to women, it could apply to people with disabilities and others, and there are ample examples of that.
Thanks, Bob, for the call. Facebook comment, a little lengthy, but I think it's an interesting one. Your private religious society has the right to govern itself as it sees fit under the First Amendment. That does not, however, give you hubris to trample the rights of others. To put it another way, your rights end at the tip of my nose. I have the right to have my relationship with my wife legally recognized. We have the right to be free from discrimination from all civil authorities. We have a right to be free from discrimination in all public accommodation, and we have a right to be to fair and equal treatment in health care, housing, and any other essential services. Despite no laws protecting the right of religious organizations to discriminate against people of color, there has never been a time when an organization was forced to marry an interracial couple following the decision in Loving v. Virginia in 1967. She goes on to say, same-sex marriage will be no different.
Boy, I like your listeners, Kathleen.
They're
whoever
smart,
that was,
they?
Yeah, they are really smart. And whoever sent that tweet in was spot on. I mean, you know, look, I think that one thing that one has to say about the American people is that when confronted with evidence of inequality or injustice, and when it's repeated in a, you know, a way that forces us to confront it, the American people, generally speaking, have been, they're good-hearted, they tend to respond to circumstances of injustice, and our Constitution has afforded an opportunity to do that. You know, during the height of the early 1960s civil rights movement, you know, it was the images of people being beaten by police officers and hosed with fire hoses coming into the homes of people all across the country that helped change attitudes that led to the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the 1965 Voting Rights Act. And so I'm confident that the American people, once educated to some of the challenges that we face today, some of the problems that we've identified, generally will come down on the side of fairness and justice. I think the Supreme Court has spoken about marriage equality. It may be something that some disagree with. You know, we understand that people have a different viewpoints, and sometimes they use religion to justify them, and that's okay too. But what we can't have is individuals taking it upon themselves to thwart the implementation of a Supreme Court decision, in this instance based on the equality principle in the 14th Amendment and the due process clause of that amendment, and trying to decide how it will selectively carry out his or her responsibilities or selectively address public needs. Licenses require, in my view, that individuals treat all consistently across the board, and that if you can't do that, then you should get out of the business that requires that kind of treatment. And private decisions, when individuals in their private capacity choose not to associate with someone, for the most part, that's fine. But it's only when you are coming in contact with the law and public requirements that you simply can't exercise those kinds of narrow views. And I think your listeners really get that, Kathleen. Thank you.
Wade Henderson is our guest. He is president, CEO of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, and is well-known and well-spoken on, as you can tell, a range of civil rights, civil liberties, and human rights issues. Our conversation is prompted by what's been happening. It varies, but the rough number is about 115 pieces of anti-LGBT legislation introduced last year in state legislatures, and probably more than that this year, including more than 25 religious freedom bills, which would have allowed, promoted, or required discrimination against LGBT, and often in the name of religious liberty. One in Michigan allowing religiously affiliated adoption agencies to discriminate against same-sex couples. One in North Carolina, just to mention a couple here, allowing magistrates to opt out of performing weddings. So we're looking at all of that, and we're getting a historical context to this because our guest has released a very interesting historical perspective, striking a balance, advancing civil and human rights while preserving religious liberty. And it looks at the issue of religious liberty and how it has been used to justify segregation, to justify lynching in some instances, to justify anti-immigration bills, anti-union bills, etc. So that's what we're on this hour. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls now for Wade, and Randy is next in Keewascom. Hi, Randy.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
A little bit ago, you were talking about the Republicans blocking President Obama's pick to fill the Supreme Court, and talk as if this is something new and unprecedented. There is a word that was created when the Democrats did it to Robert Bork. I don't recall him being on the Supreme Court. He was fully qualified. He was blocked by the Democrats. I remember getting a letter from Senator Feingold telling me how it was his right to block President Bush's nominations because he didn't agree with him. President Obama and Hillary Clinton worked to block Bush's nominations to court. So this is nothing that all of a sudden came up with the Republicans. And as far as President Obama being a liar, well, he is.
Yeah.
The Unaffordable Care Act.
All right, let's go to one issue.
Randy, let me respond to at least to the first portion of your comment, because I do think you've touched on something that has been a real argument used by those who would deny the president his right to fill the Supreme Court seat of Justice Scalia. You know, Judge Bork may have been blocked, but he was voted up or down. He wasn't blocked in the sense of his nomination blockaded in committee and not given the right to a hearing or a vote. He actually had a vote, and he was voted down. And the Senate has its ability to offer advice and consent. They can either approve an individual or they can oppose an individual, and it's their right. And it's obviously based on, we hope, an analysis of the merits that the individual presents. But we've seen nothing like this ever, Randy, where a Supreme Court nominee who has yet to be heard, we haven't gotten a nominee yet, but when that nominee comes forth, we already have a Senate leadership that's made itself clear that it will not so much as have a courtesy meeting, a hearing, or a vote on any of these candidates. And making the argument that the Senate has the right to offer its advice and consent in this way, this is a radical reinterpretation of the constitutional obligation of the Senate, something we've never seen before. And we are hopeful that senators will come to their senses and actually adopt a position which has been understood in a bipartisan way for years. There's a recent letter out which we will send to Kathleen so that she can make it available to the show. But it's a letter from historians and scholars who have looked at this issue closely, and a number of them, well-known national scholars like Doris Kearns Goodwin and others, who have taken the position that this is unusual and has never happened before. So that's really worth noting, Randy.
Thank you. We'll look forward to it, and we'll post it on our Facebook page as soon as we receive it. Thanks very much for the call, Randy. Richard is next in Monroe. Hi, Richard.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I don't know if this is in your field of expertise, but I was curious about cognitive liberty. Mm. The idea that we always have to be drug tested in this country, meaning that we're guilty until we prove ourselves innocent.
Yeah.
And also that we always have to prove that we belong to this country. We always have to have background checks that we have to pay for.
Yes.
And this, I don't understand, doesn't seem to be freedom for me. For example, people who use cannabis, which stays in your system for a month, are more likely to be popped for a drug test than people who do crystal meth, for example.
Okay, let's get a response to it.
Well, you have, Richard, raised questions that go beyond my competence, so I won't attempt to really answer them, but I think you have touched on issues of fundamental liberty and what they mean in a democratic society in the 21st century. I mean, these are issues that scholars wrestle with on a regular basis, and I hope some of our lawmakers are listening to this show as well. I think you've identified some complex questions, but I'm not going to attempt to answer them here because it's really beyond my scope of my knowledge.
Let's talk just a little more about this interesting history, religious liberty, religious freedom used in other capacities. I think people will not be aware of how it's been used, Wade, to speak against the Americans with Disabilities Act. Is that right?
Yeah.
How so?
Yeah, if you can believe that. I mean, as you know, the Americans with Disabilities Act, which was that landmark law of 1990, provides protections for people with disabilities, and it addresses discrimination in public accommodation and employment, among other areas. But during consideration of the bill, opposition came from religious groups that worried of that federal intrusion into internal church employment matters and costly changes in church buildings to accommodate people with disabilities ultimately resulted in churches should be exempt from ensuring accessibility. Mm. And that kind of discussion is just really awful. I mean, the National Association of Evangelicals argued that employment provisions in the law would represent an improper intrusion by the federal government into the internal regulation of the church. And, I mean, we've seen other instances like that. Now, fortunately, the courts have really taken a careful look at these issues and have really made judgments that we think are pretty consistent with what Americans want. You know, the case that was brought by a teacher who was fired for invoking the Americans with Disabilities Act in violation, the school said, of religious doctrine requiring the use of an internal conflict resolution process. I mean, those kinds of things, can be challenged. But, yes, the ADA has been subject to the very challenges that we're talking about here. So it's not just the LGBT community. It's also people with disabilities. It's also women. It's a source of real, you know, concern going forward.
Mm-hmm. And it's also immigrants, the Chinese Exclusion Act.
Absolutely.
You're right about that.
Absolutely. That's exactly right. Now, immigrants, I mean, have long been scapegoated in a variety of ways. And certainly, you know, in our report, we make it clear that the use of religious views to sort of block immigration is just one of the side effects of this kind of debate. It's really been a, you know, a troubling phenomenon throughout our history, and that's why we're so especially concerned about how it's being used now against the LGBT community.
So what do you imagine, just have to use a crystal ball for a little bit, what do you imagine is going to happen with the number of discriminatory laws we're going to see in 2016? And do you imagine that, you know, justice just takes a long time, as it does on many of these issues that you've outlined?
Well, sometimes that's true, but, you know, I think, interestingly enough, in the aftermath of the Supreme Court's same-sex marriage decision, there was, for the most part, automatic compliance. And the American people took a look at what the Supreme Court said, and for the most part, they accepted that. And I think the, you know, issue of discrimination against the LGBT community is falling on a regular basis, and that's the good news. Now, there is something that was introduced. You mentioned this, Kathleen, yourself, that new legislation is needed, perhaps to protect LGBT individuals from this kind of discrimination, and we couldn't agree more. There's something called the Equality Act, which was sponsored by Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon and Congressman David Cicilline of Rhode Island, that attempts to provide comprehensive protection from discrimination faced by the LGBT community in public accommodations and housing and employment and credit. And we think that that's a very important bill, and we are supporting it and urging Congress to adopt it. So we think that that kind of protection is necessary. We also think that programs like yours, Kathleen, are very helpful because they bring these issues to public attention for discussion. Your listeners have a chance to ask and pose questions. We think it's a healthy way of having debate in a democratic society.
Well, we think guests like you are helpful, too. Thank you so much for being with us. It was really a good hour. Thank you.
Thank you so much as well. I really enjoyed it.
And we will invite him back because he has a whole host of things to talk about. As you can tell, there's just a whole lot there. So we thank Wade for being with us. Wade Henderson, our guest, outgoing president and CEO of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights and the Leadership Education Fund. He will be sending us, look on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, because he will send us that letter that he mentioned on the program. And we'll also make sure that you have access to the report, which is very interesting. You know, learn your history. It's part of it is historical. Striking a balance, advancing civil and human rights while preserving religious liberty is their recent report. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to KP as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. How should the press be covering someone like Donald Trump? Hour number two of our show.